You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Hey, podcast friends, this is Ebony.
And Pamela.
We have some exciting news. You can see us
live
in January.
Yippee!
I, Ebony, am producing and hosting a concert to benefit two deserving organizations on Sunday, January 21st, 2018, at the Duplex Cabaret Theater on Christopher Street and 7th Avenue in the West Village here in New York City. It'll be at 6:30 p.m. The organizations benefited are Life After Hate, which is an organization that is working to extricate individuals who want to turn from a life of hate into a life of love and inclusivity. And the Drama Club, which is a team that works with incarcerated youth by giving them a voice through the performing arts, thereby lowering the recidivism rate. Producing with me is actress and dramaturg Jodi Beck, and our music director, Madeline Smith, has the distinction of being the youngest female Broadway conductor in history. Pamela will be
singing along with a stellar cast of other New York theater professionals. The concert will feature songs from our favorite musicals, such as Godspell, A Chorus Line, and The Scottsboro Boys. And of course, it wouldn't be a good show without Ebony's favorite of the season, Dear Evan Hansen, just to name a few.
We are very excited about this concert and hope you will join us.
For tickets, go to www.purplepass.com/typecast0121.
Which 0121 is the date, so that's how you remember it.
Yeah, that's why it's not confusing at all.
Or you can go to ebonyvines.com/currentprojects.
See you in January!
Bye!
Don't you see? It's so simple. Step one, we Google the biggest flops on Broadway. Step two, we find the crazy stories behind them. Step three, we see how they lose millions of dollars.
Millions?
Broadway isn't cheap. A lot of fancy people want to be producers. Step four, find out why the show won't go on. Step five, end this episode and head to Times Square.
Times Square? That'll never work. Only Broadway successes are in Times Square.
Oh, ye of little faith.
You have the nickel?
I do. I've got it. You ready?
I'm ready.
Call it in the air. Wait, it's been a while since I've done this.
I'm terrible at it.
Okay, ready? Call it.
Heads!
Wait, I don't know where it went.
It's in that thing.
It's heads. Ebony wins. So that means you get to choose whether you want to go first or second.
What do I want to do? I'll go second.
All right. All right. Really confident. Well, then that means.
No, I said that so confidently.
I know. That means I go first. Welcome.
Hey, theater geeks. Thank you for joining us.
This is Pamela.
And this is Ebony.
You have stumbled upon Theater Geeks Anonymous, the show where we talk about Broadway flops, scandals, and new works.
Today,
we've got another special
surprise for
you.
We have a great story. It's not so much. Usually I say, who fails, who sues, we tell their story.
Right.
Nobody really sued. Because the person, the source material was dead.
That's true.
And it was in public domain.
Yeah, there wasn't really a lot of controversy surrounding this, except for the fact that they both went on at the same time.
Yeah, they went on at the same time. And also, they're like two very strong schools. Like, so some people are very hardcore about liking one of these. And the other group is like very hardcore about liking the other one. And if you don't like theirs, they judge you.
It's true.
Yeah.
You're all wondering what we're talking about. That's right, everybody.
I bet you are.
You have reached the episode where we do the Wild Party Duel. I'm going to say it more dramatically so that I can put an echo on it. Because I'm a big fan now of
the
putting
echo.
Special effects.
The Wild Party Duel.
And see, I left myself some space there so that it can be like a long pan.
Okay. I look forward to hearing the long pan.
You should.
With the echo.
You should. There was an intermission episode, I think it was number 5, where I said, intermission, so numero cinco. And I did that echo. It was so funny to me that I just cracked myself up laughing while doing it. So if y'all figured it out by now, I'm sure you did.
Yeah, because
we flipped a coin.
Yeah.
We flipped a coin at the beginning of this episode to see who gets to go first. And I won. Well, I mean, Ebony won, but I get to go first because she told me to. Yeah. But that was what I was secretly hoping. I'm very excited about this, if you couldn't tell, because I am a big fan of both of these for very different reasons.
I don't have a preference.
Okay.
Maybe they're going to take away my geek card for saying that.
Ugh.
But in my defense, I also did not see both of them live.
I've not seen either of them live.
I have friends who have saw both live and have very strong opinions. I did see the Lipa one when Sutton did it last season.
Which we'll talk about.
We will talk about that. So that's the only one I've seen. And then, of course, I've heard this cast recording for both.
But. Yeah. Yeah. See, like, this was right after I graduated high school, and I had the cast recording for the one you were doing, which was Michael John Lacusa first, and then I got the Andrew Lipa version, and my world just opened up a little. Anywho, so if you all didn't figure that out, I am doing the Andrew Lipa version of The Wild Party. I'm going to set the scene for you. It's 2000, New York theater scene. They got a pretty rare occurrence. Not one, but two separate original musicals with separate writing and separate creative teams, but both were based on the same source material. I'll leave some space there for another little echo.
There's going to be a lot of echoing in this episode,
I think. It's my favorite. That same source material became the basis of two separate musicals. There was a Broadway version with a score by Michael John Lacusa and an off-Broadway version by Andrew Lipa. Mm-hmm. That source material was called The Wild Party. Go figure. It was a book-length narrative poem written by Joseph Moncure March. Mm-hmm. The poem was widely banned upon its 1928 publication for having content viewed as wild, as wild as the titular party, is what it said. The poem was a success despite, and perhaps partly due to, the controversy surrounding the work. Mm-hmm. And although March's subsequent projects were more mainstream, this remains one of his more well-known. Lipa's edition began its life with a reading at the O'Neill Theater Center in 1999. 1 year later, the work opened off-Broadway at the Manhattan Theater Club, going on to enjoy a run of 54 performances. Though the initial run was brief, its fans in the theater community were passionate, as you mentioned before. A cast recording was made and released after the production closed, and The Wild Party became a popular show for colleges and amateur groups to produce. This Wild Party especially has been done regionally all over the place. I'm not sure if that's the true that's true of yours. But yeah, it's really amazing to me how many times I see or hear, oh yeah, the Lipa version's going up over there. So that's really cool. So here's a little bit of a synopsis of the Lipa version. Just so we're clear. Act 1. It's the roaring 1920s, and the beautiful young Queenie, although she tries, cannot find a lover able to satisfy her desires. Until she meets Burrs, a vaudevillian clown with a voracious appetite for women. Both Queenie and Burrs have now met their emotional and sexual match. For a while, they live together happily sated. Eventually, however, the relationship sours. Burr's violent nature, which once thrilled Queenie, now scares her. Still, she longs to generate the same excitement that brought them together. She suggests a party, and Burrs agrees. The party begins with a parade of guests. Madeline the lesbian, Eddie the thug, May the dimwit, Jackie the dancer, lover/brothers, Oscar and Phil D'Armano, Dolores the hooker, and Nadine the miner. Although Queenie radiates beauty and confidence, Burrs preys on other women. He makes his move on their youngest guest, Nadine. Despite her casual reprimand of his behavior, Queenie wants to hurt Burrs in return. The vivacious Kate arrives with her new friend, Mr. Black. Queenie, quite taken with Black, plans to make her move on him. Kate drags him away to meet the other guests. Queenie's plans are momentarily undermined. The party's revelry, easy for me to say, continues. Burrs hits on Kate, Madeline hits on Nadine, Eddie chugs beer and almost fights with Burrs. During the chaos, Black finds himself equally as taken with Queenie as she is with him, much to the chagrin of Kate. As revenge, Kate plans on seducing Burrs. Meanwhile, in a corner of the room, Madeline is in a drunken stupor and on the prowl for a woman with very little success. Although Queenie is fully aware that Burrs will threaten her physically, she makes her move on Mr. Black. That sentence just is so odd to me, but it's, I guess this is sometimes how people act. She makes her move on Mr. Black, easily getting him to dance with her. Burrs watches them, his ire rising. Unsuccessfully, Kate tries to get Burrs to dance. Then, in order to defuse the situation, Kate takes Queenie out of Mr. Black's arms and dances with her instead. Burrs' violent reaction against Mr. Black and Queenie is prohibited by the whole company dancing the juggernaut. At its end, Mr. Black and Queenie are back together again. They get to get the reaction that he wants from Queenie, Burrs grabs Nadine, the miner, and makes out with her. This enrages Kate, who throws Nadine to the ground by her hair. Madeline rushes to the aid of Nadine. Burrs cuts in to Mr. Black and Queenie's dancing. Managing to have her to himself, Burrs tells Queenie to stay away from Mr. Black. Laughing at him, Queenie says she'll do whatever she chooses. He twists her arm. They're interrupted by Oscar and Phil at the piano. Burr releases Queenie, seeing that there are too many people watching. Burrs and Queenie join Oscar and Phil's epic musical number based on the story of Adam and Eve. Burrs plays Adam, Queenie plays Eve, and their number is interrupted by a discontented neighbor. Eddie and May yell insults at the man, and the crowd goes wild. The two celebrate their togetherness. That's Eddie and May, their togetherness. Suddenly, Mr. Black approaches Queenie and pointedly asks why she stays with an abusive brute. She reflects on her situation and comes to the conclusion that perhaps she's just learned to like the aggressive treatment. Elsewhere, Kate is attempting to seduce Burrs. He refuses her advances and expresses his deepest, darkest feelings for Queenie. She's driving him crazy. Kate tries to kiss Burrs, but he pushes her away. Black kisses Queenie. She embraces him. Act two.
Holy mackerel.
Right? The party rages on. Kate is alone and reflecting on her youthful indulgence. Alone in the bathroom, Queenie is taking stock of her predicament. Although she's angry that she has confided in Black, a virtual stranger, she recognizes his goodness. This both stirs and confuses her feelings. Black enters the bathroom with a drink. The two share a moment as Black conveys his admiration for Queenie. Suddenly, Burrs comes in seeking Queenie's attention. He apologizes for his behavior and asks for her forgiveness. Before she can respond, Kate arrives. She unsuccessfully... This must be a big bathroom, by the way. It wouldn't happen in my bathroom.
mine neither.
She unsuccessfully tries to draw Burrs back onto the dance floor. Both men pull for her affections and devotion. Mr. Black asks Queenie to leave the apartment with him. Burrs asks her to stop the party and let them return to their isolation. Queenie is unable to respond to either man. Frustrated and hurt, Burrs lashes out by physically threatening her. His outburst causes Queenie to leave the bathroom, and Black quickly follows. It is clear that Burrs is quickly becoming desperate and depressed. Soon after, he begins to hallucinate and hear Queenie's voice in his head. Thinking May is Queenie, he mistakenly attacks her and angers Eddie. A fight ensues. Mr. Black and Queenie return to find Eddie viciously beating Burrs. Queenie is afraid that Burrs will be killed if it's not stopped. Out of concern, Black rushes in, knocks Eddie unconscious with a chair. May tends to Eddie. Kate comes to the aid of the passed out Burrs. Realizing all of the trouble he's causing, Mr. Black tells Queenie that he'll leave. Queenie, however, cannot let him go and leads him into the bedroom. In a moment of passion, the two begin making love. The party guests follow suit in the living room. Whew, this is kind of party. Mm-hmm. Early the next morning, the revelers, why can I not say revelry or anything like it? The partygoers lie asleep in the living room. Kate wakes Burrs, who is beside her. Queenie is strikingly absent. Burrs, fearing the worst, staggers to the bedroom to find her in the bed with Black. When the two lovers wake, Queenie recoils in shock. Black jumps up and attempts to tackle Burrs but fails. Burrs moves to the dresser, locates a gun. Full of rage, he vacillates between trying to force Queenie to make a choice between the two men. He threatens to kill Black and also threatens to kill himself. Black, who realizes that Burrs is about to make a decision, takes a chance and lunges at Burrs. The gun goes off. Burrs is dead. Fearing that Mr. Black will now be executed for the death, Queenie urges him to flee. Before leaving, Black professes his love for her. Queenie, now having lost both men, questions how things managed to reach that point of loss. She exits the apartment with her coat, all eyes upon her, sad, beautiful Grace. The end. That is a packed show.
Yeah.
So some of the productions that were done. The musical, as I said before, was performed at the Eugene O'Neill Theater Center in 1997. Oh, I didn't mention this before.
No.
There was a workshop done in 1997 that actually had Kristen Chenoweth. And I read an interview that Andrew Lippa had done where he said, he was asked, you know, what did you think about hiring Kristen Chenoweth to do your original workshop? And he said, oh, you know what? Eugene O'Neill Theater Center doesn't really have auditions. They just say, you know, these are the people that are available if you want to use them. And so no one at that point really knew Kristen Chenoweth. She had maybe done Steel Pier at that point.
Okay.
But nothing else. Mm-hmm. She hadn't done Charlie Brown, and that's really what put her on the map.
Yeah.
And so she was just this unknown, but Andrew Lippa loved her so much. It was, and that now they still collaborate on different projects together today. So that's kind of cool. But she played May in that production. The musical opened off-Broadway on February 24th, 2000 at the Manhattan Theater Club, and it ran for 54 performances before closing on April 9th. Directed by Gabriel Barr and choreographed by Mark Dendy, it starred Julia Murney as Queenie, Brian D'Arcy James, whom I love, as Burrs. let's see, Taye Diggs as Mr. Black and Idina Menzel as Kate, and Alex Corey as Madeline True to finish off the cast. A cast album was actually recorded a week after they closed because of popular demand. There were so many people that were, you know, upset that the show had to close. And I couldn't find information about why it had to close.
Well,
other than I think that just the season.
Like, right. Because it was like, as far as I've heard, it was supposed to be like a limited run.
Yeah. And they did extend it.
Right. And then there was talk that it would move to Broadway.
Right.
And that's the bit that, like, I don't really know why it didn't move to Broadway.
I wish there was more information on that. I do have a little bit that I'll get into. But, yeah, I couldn't really find a lot. Let's see. That cast recording was released by RCA Records. Mm-hmm. And it's definitely worth listening to if you've been living under a rock and haven't heard it. let's see. Oh, in 2004, The Wild Party was produced as part of the Edinburgh Festival Fringe in Scotland.
Fringe Festival?
It's Festival Fringe, actually, because I looked it up. I didn't want to say something stupid, and so I actually looked it up, and it is Edinburgh Festival Fringe.
What year again?
2004.
Wonder if one of my friends was working the Edinburgh Fringe.
Yeah.
I don't know what year, though, so.
Cool. That would be neat if it was.
Yeah.
It has been staged in cities throughout the United States, including St. Louis, Chicago, Baltimore, Cincinnati, Memphis, Valparaiso, Indiana, and Reno, just to name a few. New York City Center's Encores Off Center series presented a staged concert version of The Wild Party as the final production of its 2015 season, and that's what you were just talking about.
Yeah.
It ran July 15th through the 18th. With direction by Lee Silverman and choreography by Sonia Taya, who does a lot of choreography on So You Think You Can Dance. That's how I know her. She's really very good, though. It featured Sutton Foster as Queenie, Stephen Pasquale. I never know how to say his last name.
Pasquale.
Yeah. Okay, I'm going to hope that's right. He was actually Brian D'Arcy James' understudy in the original off-Broadway production. Isn't that cool?
I didn't know that.
And Andrew Lippa, in that same interview that I spoke of earlier, said that he loved Stephen Pasquale.
It's going to be like me last night.
Yep. He loved Stephen Pasquale, but he was just a little too young to play the role. Obviously, Brian D'Arcy James did an amazing job, but he said, you know, if it had ever come down to it, he wanted to see him play it. He just wasn't quite old enough yet.
Yeah.
So it's good that he got another chance. Let's see. Brandon Victor Dixon is Mr. Black, which I bet was just amazing.
Yeah, it was.
This is another name that I have no idea how to pronounce. Joaquina Kalukango.
We hope we got it right.
I know. I'm so sorry if I didn't. And Miriam Shore as Madeline True. Oh, and Ryan Andes as Eddie. So what happened? According to Playbill, this is what they wrote. Well, it won't be moving to Broadway, but Manhattan Theater Club's The Wild Party, the new musical by composer-lyricist-librettist Andrew Lippa, has proved popular enough to extend another week until April 9th. The Dark Edge Tuner is also due to be recorded. The cast will gather in the studio a few days after the show closes. Last week, producers Jeffrey Seller and Kevin McCollum, of Rent fame, reportedly said
also
in a
Hamilton.
Statement, Oh, yeah?
Well, Jeffrey...
Oh, okay.
Yeah, they went their separate ways, but yeah. Jeffrey did Hamilton.
Oh, okay, cool. They said in a statement that they are thrilled with the production, but it doesn't make sense to transfer to Broadway in the current environment. Now, whether that means because there's another show on Broadway that's the same title and the same source material, or if it's just simply the wrong time of year, because summer is also a little bit of a dead... Well, no, actually, summer is a big season. This would have been April.
The thing that I read, because one of the... A lot of people feel like, you know, the Broadway version shouldn't have closed.
Yeah.
But, you know, that a lot of the articles I read, they just felt like it was a period of time where people wanted more escapism, maybe.
Okay.
And so maybe people
wanted
something.
They didn't want to be dredged down with this kind of
pseudo-reality. Right. They wanted something lighter.
Yeah.
They wanted, like, the old school sort of lighthearted.
Sure.
You know, Broadway musical. And so... That's what I read in a lot of articles that people felt like maybe that's why.
That could be. I mean, you're right. I feel like the 1990s were just full of that kind of dark, heavy material. Yeah. But then you're right. Maybe the 2000s were just the turnaround.
Especially, I mean, a few months or a year later than we had, you know.
9/11. Absolutely. The musical drawn from this 1928 verse poem... got mixed reviews after its February 24th opening at MTC Stage. Another musical version of the poem, I don't know, I've got all of this information all kind of from different sources, so some of it's repeat information, so I do apologize. Another musical version of the poem was being staged on Broadway beginning March 10th at the Virginia Theater, and you'll speak about that.
Right.
But it was also dubbed The Wild Party. So I think that was within the same article by Playbill. So maybe that was part of the issue as well. The critical reception was actually fairly good. Ben Brantley of the New York Times said that Lippa's score was jittery, had a jittery wandering quality, conscientiously shifting styles and tempos as if in search of a lost chord. The ballads are of high decibel, swooning pop variety made popular by Frank Wildhorn. Mr. Lippa fares better with the pastiches of jazz and vaudeville. So it's, I mean, I guess it's not great. It's on the fence a little bit. Although these two, these other styles, jazz, vaudeville, and gospel, do suffer by comparison to the Candor Ebb songs from Chicago. Which I guess would it, Chicago and Cabaret, both the revivals came up the year prior. So I think people were looking for some sort of comparison to that.
Right. Yeah. They were saying that a lot in the Lacusa one, too.
Yeah. So I wonder, that's probably part of it, too.
Yeah.
You know, you're looking for a certain kind of show and you just kind of get a pale representation of it. So it's not as fulfilling, it's not as satisfying. The Wild Party may not be the perfect musical we've all been looking for, but it's great fun to watch and puts enough talent on display to have warranted a longer run than it will have. So that was kind of nice. That was a curtain-up reviewer. Variety says, the first challenge facing the creators of these musicals is how to win over an audience with such nasty material. His music is very, Lippa's music is very accessible, but that's the problem. It's accessible because you feel you've heard it before. Oh. And they also say that his lyrics are rudimentary. So, you know, I mean.
It's like mixed reviews.
Yeah.
Which is Lacuse's had the same thing. Sure. It was like mixed reviews.
Yeah, so nothing could really hold it together. It was like a tart that didn't have a crust that was well baked. I'm watching the Great British.
Didn't have enough egg.
Yeah, right, right.
Yeah,
I'm watching the Great British Bake Off right now, and so I'm, you know, I've got all these baking stuff in my mind. I do have a little comparison to Lacuse's Wild Party that I was able to find online, and unfortunately, I don't have written down where I found it.
Okay.
So I'm not sure who to give credit to. So I do apologize for that. But it states. The Andrew Lippa and the Michael John Lacusa versions of the Wild Party are markedly different in their storylines. In Lippa's version, the plot is tightly focused on the central love triangle of Joseph Moncure Marsh's original poem, and the cast is much smaller. Many of the characters in Lacusa's version do not appear in Lippa's version at all, or have much smaller roles. Mm-hmm. Notably, Dolores, who is Lacusa's, in Lacusa's version, was a major supporting role, who was originated by Eartha Kitt.
Yeah.
And I'm sure you'll bring her up later. I love her. She was amazing.
Yeah.
There are major differences in the music and tone of the two shows as well. And that's absolutely true. Lippa's songs are not wholly dependent on the plot of the show and can be understood arguably better than Lacusa's out of context. And I will agree with that wholeheartedly. Mm-hmm. I had Lacusa's version first and I think probably memorized before I actually bought the Lippa version. Mm-hmm. But I had so much trouble figuring out what the story was by listening to the cast recording. And that's one of my favorite things to do before I, you know, open up the liner notes and read the libretto and read, you know, what the synopsis is. Like, I like to figure out what the story is by listening to the songs. Mm-hmm. And then when you can't figure it out, it's not necessarily a fun mystery to figure out. It's kind of frustrating.
I because I'd already seen it, like, before I had listened to it.
Oh, sure.
That I didn't have trouble, but maybe it's because I saw it already.
Yeah.
So.
Well, you saw the Lippa version, though, right?
I did see the Lippa version.
Yeah, I'm speaking to the Lacusa version.
Right, but, like, I still understand, you know what I mean?
Gotcha.
Like, I sort of am like, okay, so even
Yeah,
like,
yeah,
oh, that happened. Okay, this is the part that's happening there. Oh, okay, this is probably what's happening there.
Yeah.
Because I have some sort of context for what the story is.
I get that.
Yeah.
let's see. Oh, comparatively, the Lacusa score is tightly interwoven with the plot of the show. Excuse me. Stylistically, Lacusa mimics the jazz of the era, while Lippa uses deliberately anachronistic pop rock sound, complete with guitars. I wouldn't call it a pop rock sound. Mm-hmm. I would call it more contemporary musical theater.
Yeah.
But he is very correct in his estimation. The Lacusa version is very much the sound of
Absolutely.
That period.
That's like why he wanted to do it.
I think so. And he did it very well, I think. And the performers were so wholeheartedly invested in that sound as well.
Yeah.
Mandy Patinkin.
Yeah.
Especially when he does his, and well, you'll mention it later.
Yeah.
But the sound of the season, I think, was more Lippa's of that of the 2000 season.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, you know, I think that's why people are so
divided
for or against.
Yeah, one
you
or
know?
The other.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think, I mean, I can look at both of them and say I love both of them and I can see the merits in both styles, but I do have a favorite that I listen to.
Yeah.
You know?
I feel like, you know, most people have that. I'm like the weird one where I'll listen to either one.
Yeah.
I don't have a strong leaning either way. That's why when we were deciding who was going to do what, and I was like, whatever you want to do, which one do you want to do? And you were like, I want my box. I was like, okay.
Well, and I think, well, I don't know, maybe this is different for all people, but when I listen to a soundtrack or a cast recording of something, I want to sing along.
Mm-hmm.
And so when something is more difficult to sing along to, it's not as fun to listen to.
Okay.
Lippa's version is so easy to sing, even the male parts. Like, it's so easy to be sung. And Lacusa is so intricate. I feel like this is true of most of Lacusa's work, though.
Mm-hmm.
Hello Again is one of those other shows where you're just like, how... It's so difficult, like, technically speaking, the music is so intricate and so technically detailed that it's difficult to pick apart, and you can't just find the melody line and follow along.
Okay.
So I think for me, at least, that's why Lippa is so much more attractive to listen to. But only for that reason.
Right. That, you know? I mean, that would make sense. Yeah. I can't sing, so it does. Me, it's like all the same. I couldn't sing any of it.
Well, there you go.
Yeah.
But there is a song in Lacusa's version called After Midnight Dies that is my favorite. It is my favorite. It's so good.
I really, really enjoyed listening to it.
It's so good.
But also, I love jazz music, and yeah, I love Duke Ellington and Ella Fitzgerald. Like, I love them.
And do you know what else? Me too. But, like, there is this kind of tension from start to finish in Lacusa's version that makes me feel on edge the whole time.
Which is, like, you should, because it's something terrible is
and
going to happen.
Such an emotional connection. And Toni Collette and Mandy Patinkin both. Well, everyone's performances, but Mandy and Toni especially, just have this amazing...
Once you hear some of their backs, the backs, like, what was happening backstage, you'll be like, oh.
Oh, no.
So, okay.
Okay. Well, go. Ready, set, go.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com.
All right, so I'm going to talk about Michael John Lacusa's version. So the whole thing started because the Public Theater commissioned him to write a musical. And he decided that this was the show that he wanted to write. He had read the short story, and he was attracted to the 1920s jazz age of Duke Ellington and the Cotton Club recordings of 1928 and 29.
Yeah,
is what I said, right?
Yeah.
In a Playbill article from the rehearsals, Michael John Lacusa said, a line from the poem describing Queenie particularly grabbed him. Her face was a tinted mask of snow. The words leapt out at me, Lacusa says. I wondered what was beneath the mask. I wanted to know who she was, what propelled her to become who she was, and what propels all of us to wear masks. The wild party itself is not just a party. It's a metaphor for our day-to-day existence.
Wow.
So I think that also speaks to what you were talking about, like the constant tension throughout the piece, because it's definitely about like what's happening inside of Queenie and like this life she's living. And the show was presented as a series of vaudeville sketches complete with signs at the beginning and the end, but they were abandoned for most of the show. Again, I didn't see it. So
I didn't either. Like the sandwich boards, like a vaudeville show sandwich board
sign? It would be something like that. Or I think Scottsboro Boys may have done this
probably.
As well. Like they would.
In listening to the cast recording of Wild Party, it does seem like that. Like someone takes a bow. You know, I think I remember that being in one of the lyrics.
I think Scottsboro Boys was more, oh shoot, I forget what the genre is. Somebody's screaming at me, especially my friends. It'll come to me. Freaking love Scottsboro Boys. Anyway, but yeah, it's like that. The signs, you know, saying like this is what's happening, whatever.
Yeah.
Anyway, and they were announcing the next scene, propped on an easel at the side of the stage.
Yeah, that's there what I was. That was what I was picturing. Yep.
Queenie and Burrs, whose relationship is disintegrating, host a party fueled by bathtub gin, cocaine, and uninhibited sexual behavior. It quickly devolves into an orgy that culminates in tragedy. The guests include faded star Dolores, Kate, Queenie's best friend and rival, Black, Kate's younger lover, who has his eye on Queenie, Jack, a rich ambisextrous kid, who has his eye on everyone, regardless of gender or age. Oscar and Phil D'Armano, a gay couple brother act. lesbian stripper Miss Madeline True and her morphine-addicted girlfriend Sally, which was
Sally sings after... No.
Right, because I was like, when you said people, I don't remember you mentioning Sally.
No, Sally was never... No, because Madeline True came going, single to the party.
Right, and she was like trying to find someone.
Yeah, she was trying to get with Nadine.
Okay. Yep.
Sally sings after midnight dies, though. Yes. That song that I was talking about. Yeah.
Song.
It's such a good song.
And then prize fighter Eddie and his white wife May and May's underage Lolita's sister Nadine. Okay.
I just wanted to see the lights of Broadway.
All right. So I'm going to give a synopsis of the Michael John Lacusa version. Some of this we'll probably repeat. Again, it's the same source material.
Yeah.
So. Oh, also, just a like little side note, the reason why like it was so easy to get a hold of this piece is because it was in the public domain by the time that Michael and Andrew were, you know, deciding on what they wanted to write on. So it was just like easy to get. They didn't have to go through anybody and get rights or anything. Okay. So at the beginning of the show, the company recounts the story of Queenie, a blonde who works as a showgirl in the vaudeville, who is attracted to violent and vicious men. Queenie was a blonde and her age stood still. Everybody knows that line. She's currently living with a man named Burrs who works in the same vaudeville, who works in vaudeville as well, and is the act after her. His act is a minstrel show. That's the Scottsboro
and I was
Boys.
Say minstrel show.
I was like, why can't I remember? And then boom.
I was totally going to say it, too.
Yes. That's what Scottsboro Boys is, a minstrel show.
Yes.
Okay. Okay. Anyway, so his act is a minstrel show where he performs in blackface. And then the song Marie is Tricky is one of those. One Sunday, Queenie wakes up restless and she and Burrs soon come to blows. To try to put less strain on their relationship and to convince her to put a knife down, Burrs suggests they throw a huge party and invite all the old gang. Queenie is ecstatic and they get prepared for the evening, the wild party. Promenade of guests. The guests soon arrive and exchange words with Burrs and alcohol starts flowing. Then the song Dry comes in. Queenie makes her appearance in a quote-unquote new dress. My Beautiful Blonde is the song they sing there. And welcomes everyone. Meeting Nadine, a minor who wants to be a blonde and drink bathtub gin, Queenie takes her under her wing as she mingles with the other guests. Madeline, an almost famous stripper, introduces Queenie to her new girlfriend, the catatonic, morphine-addicted Sally, who she met crawling outside the theater in a drug stupor. Madeline believes Sally is a postmodernist, to which Burrs replies, in need of a postmortem. Madeline tells Queenie of their love and of Sally's genius. Next up is Jackie, an ambisextrous rich kid with his eye on anybody and everybody. The incestuously devoted
Darmano
brothers. I always have some name I can't do. Oscar and Phil sing a new ditty as Gold and Goldberg. Two would-be producers arrive. They're planning to move uptown, and Burrs is convinced that they want to take him. He joins in with the brothers to impress them in the song Uptown. Queenie wonders where her friend Kate is, and Burrs expresses his dislike for her. Eddie, a successful black boxer, and his white wife May talk of their marriage in Eddie and May. Dolores, a faded star, hints to Burrs that she knows his secrets and forces him to introduce her to Gold and Goldberg. The producers are fighting over their name, with Gold wanting to change Goldberg's name to Golden to hide their Jewish heritage and how to become successful. Burrs introduces them to Dolores, who begins to Burrs introduces them to Dolores, who begins to seduce them with her feminine wiles in the song Moving Uptown. The Party. Queenie starts a dance to raise the energy in the song Black Bottom, but Kate soon interrupts with her arrival. She has come with Mr. Black, an attractive gigolo. Queenie and Kate trade insults and love, telling Nadine of their double-edged friendship in the song Best Friend. Burrs and Kate do not get along, with Kate disapproving of Queenie's romantic entanglement with him. While Queenie and Black begin to feel an attraction to each other, That's just funny because of Queenie's choices, but fine. Meanwhile, Jackie tries to separate the Darmano brothers, flirting with Oscar. Dolores hints to Queenie about troubles in Burr's past in the song Everybody Has Their Secrets. With Nadine, while Nadine sings a P-A-E-A-N? Payan?
Yeah, I guess so.
While Nadine sings a lovely song to Broadway, only to be cut off by Queenie, the lights of Broadway.
I always wanted to see the lights of Broadway.
Mm-hmm. Okay, go.
Queenie and Black meet up and find their attraction growing stronger in the song Taboo. Queenie asks him to show her how he picks up ladies, and his hypothetical soon turns into a real proposition in the song Taking Care of the Ladies. And he pulls her to dance in Taboo Dance. Kate and Burrs notice how close Queenie and Black are becoming, and Burrs wonders about the demise of fidelity in the song Wouldn't It Be Nice. Queenie tells Black of her troubled existence, wondering why she was born in Low Down Down. As Burrs hypes up the party with gin, the party quickly escalates with everybody drinking, dancing, and arguing. Dolores warns Queenie of Burrs' first wife, who he beat to death.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, that's wow. And Queenie escapes to the bathroom. There. The party quickly escalates with everybody drinking and dancing and arguing. Dolores warns Queenie of Burr's first wife, who he beat to death, and Queenie escapes to the bathroom. There, she is confronted by Burrs of her There, she is confronted by Burrs of her entanglement with Black, and he begins to assault her. Kate barges in and saves Queenie, and Burrs furiously rejoins the party with a coked-up Jackie. Kate and Queenie argue about her relationship with Burrs as Jackie and Oscar are found having sex in the bathroom. Oscar and Phil argue publicly while May and Eddie exchange heated words. Kate warns Queenie that Burrs will kill her, and when Queenie refuses to listen, Kate jumps back into the party. Eddie and May soon come to blows, hitting each other, as Dolores seduces Gold and Goldberg, bringing them into the bedroom. Distraught with the state of the party, Queenie is dragged out by Black as the party continues in full swing in the song Wild. Madeline searches for Sally and asks her to say her name. The guests all gather and culminate in an orgy in the song Need. As Burrs asks Kate about Black, Kate reveals that she knows Black is using her, but she is fine with it in the song Black is a Moocher. Yeah.
Black is a moocher, and I like it like that.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Outside, Queenie and Black bond at the fact that they are different from the rest, wondering where they belong and what will become of them in the song People Like Us. I really like that song.
Me too.
After Midnight Dies. So this is the last part, I think?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah,
this is the end. Sally, naked, carrying her clothes, reveals she can see clearly now what she and everyone else is.
And that's a really poorly written sentence.
It's a terribly written sentence. In the song After Midnight Dies, she finds...
I don't know if I mentioned this. It's one of my favorites.
She finds Eddie recounting how it feels to beat someone acclaimed, but still be detested in the song Golden Boy, which... is a musical, which I think is about a black boxer.
Yeah.
Golden Boy. She notices Oscar and Phil making up and turns to find Gold and Goldberg. Pants nowhere to be found, wondering what has happened to them. Dolores appears and warns them that their promise must be kept or terrible things will happen in the song Moving Uptown Blues. She then sneaks into the bedroom where Nadine has just done her first line of coke with Jackie. At Nadine's request for more, Jackie laments how he can never get enough of anything, culminating in rape in the song More. Mm-hmm. May hears Nadine's muffled screams, and Eddie charges in and beats Jackie. Eddie goes wild, threatening everyone as Queenie and Black arrive. When Eddie charges at Queenie, Black hits him. Queenie questions Nadine on what had happened with Jackie, but she refuses to call him out, instead saying she was scared and screamed. Jackie tries to start the party up again and takes out more cocaine. Seeing the coke, Sally goes to him, leaving Madeline. Madeline chases after her, but is stopped when Sally asks, "Who's Sally?" The guests are told to leave by Burrs, and they disappear into the background. Kate confronts Black, telling him that Queenie will choose Burrs, and he will have nowhere to go. Burrs and Queenie come to blows as she reveals she knows about his wife in the song "Love Ain't Nothing, Welcome to Her Party." Queenie refuses to let Burrs make up her mind and leaves with Black. Burrs wonders how many other women could make him feel the way she does before concluding it is just her in the song "How Many Women in the World." Gold and Goldberg tell him they had no intention of taking him uptown with them, and he begins to put on his vaudeville makeup. Dolores recounts how she used to love the dark, but now she loves the cold, hard light that spares no one. She enjoys knowing who has the stuff and who doesn't to survive in the song "When It Ends." Okay, this is the actual finale, what's coming right now. Okay. Dun, 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 dun.
I'm going to put an echo on that.
Queenie and Black lie in bed as Queenie wonders what it is to live in light and love. In the song, "This Is What It Is," Burrs, done up in blackface, mimics the guests before entering the bedroom. He pulls out a gun and threatens to kill Queenie. Black fights him, and Burrs is shot dead and falls on the bed. Kate rushes in and hurries Black to safety. So that's like a twist, right?
Mm-hmm.
The company does the opening vaudeville, trying to lure Queenie into its revelry. Queenie tries, but soon begins to take off her makeup, the company dropping the vaudeville and joining her. Queenie is bathed in morning light, scared, unsure, but hopeful. She smiles at the dawn. Totally different. Wow.
Yeah.
That's super different.
That you can... Who would be able to be hopeful after that?
Right! Like, how?
And what I did read when I was doing research about mine was that the Toni Collette character of Queenie was much more childish in her portrayal, and in the writing of her. Okay. Was much more spoiled child as opposed to adult making these debauched decisions.
Okay.
And so she did everything in reaction. So I suppose at the end of all of this, she could kind of look back on the total of her life and say, okay, I need to grow up now. And maybe that is where the hope comes in. Okay. I don't know for sure, but
could be.
So tell me more.
The cast and creative was as follows. Lyrics and music were by Michael John Lacusa. The book was by Lacusa and George C. Wolfe.
Oh.
Yeah. The direction was by George C. Wolfe. Choreography by Joey McKinley, and set design by Robin Wagner. Costume design by Toni Leslie James. Toni Collette played Queenie. Mandy Patinkin played Burrs. Yancey Arias played Black. Eartha Kitt played Dolores. Mark Kudish played Jackie.
I love him.
Me too. I also love this man, Norm Lewis.
Oh.
Played Eddie Mackerel.
Yes.
Yeah, love him. And Tanya Pinkins played Kate.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
The show played a workshop at the Public Theater from February 15th to February 26th in 1999 with Vanessa Williams playing Queenie.
Yes, I heard about that original casting, but then she got pregnant.
That's right. That's exactly right. So... it was Vanessa Williams playing Queenie. Mandy Patinkin was still playing Burrs, and Eartha Kitt was still playing Dolores at that workshop. All right. So although Eartha's role was reduced over the course of workshop productions, she still returned to Broadway after an absence of more than 20 years, creating the role of Dolores. The four were backed by a large ensemble cast, each of whom has featured song or key moments to take center stage. The show was nominated for 7 Tony Awards. So it was Toni Collette as Best Leading Actress in a Musical, Eartha Kitt as Best Featured Actress in a Musical, Mandy Patinkin was Best Leading Actor in a Musical, and it was also nominated for Best Musical.
Do you remember seeing that performance?
Oh, yeah.
It was amazing.
Yeah. I watched it with my mom because my mom, like Eartha Kitt, my mom was like, it's Eartha Kitt. Oh, my God. Yeah.
That was an all skate. Every single cast member was on the stage during that musical number. It was really, really good.
It was
good.
Wonderful.
It was really good.
I absolutely remember that. Like, whenever anyone says the Wild Party, like, that's what first pops in my head.
Totally.
That performance on the Tony Awards. In 2001, Lacusa said the role of Queenie was written for Vanessa Williams, who was replaced with Colette when she became pregnant. Lacusa said, I don't think of it as something that was lost in the piece, but it would have been fascinating to see how an audience responded to a black Queenie.
Especially when her counterpart is in blackface later on.
Yeah.
That really would be something
That's
to see.
Great. Yeah.
Talk about tension.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
The show is all about the masks that we wear culturally and the removal of those masks over the course of the party. So it's all there.
Yeah.
That's what he said.
Cool.
So here's some okay. So there's a lot of speculation as to why the show closed early. Some people think it was political in terms of in the theater world. Mm. There are a lot of stories of trouble backstage.
Oh, that's right. You alluded to that.
Yeah, a lot of stories. Okay. So one of them that's pretty well known is Manti Patinkin.
Mm-hmm. I knew you were going to start with that, and I'm so excited you are.
Okay, so there's a pretty epic Michael Riedel article, and I'm going to read bits and bobs of it. Okay, so Michael starts out. Mandy gives an intense and frightening performance as Burrs. But for many of his fellow cast members, Patinkin's performance has at times been a little too intense, a little too frightening, and a little too real. So there were stories that he spit in Eartha Kitt's face.
Oh, on stage?
Yeah, on stage,
in character. But yeah.
Cast members say that during previews, the actor had ad-libbed bits of physical and verbal abuse, including smacking people in the head, shoving them, spitting water in their faces, and making offensive remarks to them under his breath.
Oh, yikes.
He also has been prone to strange emotional outbursts. The actors say they were never sure what Patinkin was going to do to them on stage. And one said, they walked around like they were wearing lead underwear for protection.
Oh, goodness. Do you remember... it was, I think, when Batman Begins was being filmed, and there was a TMZ video that came out of Christian Bale just losing his stuff.
Yeah.
Losing it on this, this unsuspecting crew guy who just happened to mess up a shot.
Right.
And at first everyone was just so, they were like, come on, Christian, you're not that big a deal, that kind of stuff.
Right.
That was the reaction that most people had. But I remember thinking that when you are emotionally invested in a scene, that sometimes you cannot control who or what comes out in a moment that surprises you.
That's right.
And I mean, that's a good actor, because you're just wholly invested.
So there's that story I think I told you about where my friend Kevin will let me know if I've gotten the names wrong, and I'll put it in corrections corner or rewrites in an intermission sode if I have. But I believe he told me the story about, I believe it was Geraldine Page slapping Maya Angelou.
Oh, my goodness.
She had this habit.
I think I remember. Yes, I think I remember reading about this. Tell me, though.
She had this, she was, super intense, right? And so she would get just, really into a scene, and she would just, slap people in the middle of the scene. And it's not like she was angry at them. She just was, so into it, and she just had all these feelings, and she would just haul off and slap people. So then apparently it wasn't Maya Angelou, but it was another actress that she slapped. And it's been said, critics said after, it was the best performance that actress gave, the entire run of the show, right? So he said, and man, he's if he listens to this, he's going to be yelling the answer to this, but there was one actress who, like, she heard that this happened, and she happened to be in a play with Geraldine Page.
Oh,
and she went to Geraldine Page, and she was like, slap me! Because she wanted to give, like, the best performance of her life, right? And because she heard, like, the slapping apparently helped one actor, goodness. Like, she wanted to be slapped, too.
Yeah, but not if you're expecting it.
Right.
I mean, the slap will put you in a state of mind that just ups the ante.
Right.
So, like, I mean, that's what it is. There's that horrible story about, like, I wish that I could remember the movie. It was Marlon Brando and whoever the director was. Got together, and they were just about to film a rape scene, but without the actress knowing, they talked about what they were going to do, and then did it in the scene. But it was like he used a stick of butter to kind of like to as like a lubricant and that kind of thing. But she was completely unaware that any of this stuff was going to happen, and their whole thought process behind this was, you know, in a real rape, you're going to be surprised. You're going to, you know, you're never going to know what your reaction is going to be. So we didn't want it to be scripted. We didn't want it to be acting. We wanted it to be real. But that, my friends, is called rape. Or at the very least, sexual assault in this scene. And there is a fine line. I love the idea of surprising your castmates, but you still have to be able to trust who you're on stage with.
Yeah.
And if you cannot trust them, or if you think they're going to haul off and slap you at any moment, you can't play together.
No. And
you
like,
just can't.
And like, In a musical this intense.
Yeah.
You know, like, I have a dear friend who told me a story once of when she was in Taming of the Shrew. Actually, I interviewed her, and she told me the story. She was in Taming of the Shrew. She was playing Kate. And the actor who was playing, what's his name?
Oh, the character's name?
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm so sorry. Stink. I'm so bad at Shakespeare. I'm a bad actor.
It'll come to me later. But
Last Tango in Paris, by the way, is that movie. I just looked it up.
Oh.
Maria Schneider is the actress. But, like, there's... anyway.
That's awful.
I'll let you get back to your story.
Absolutely awful.
There is a story that you can look up. I think The Guardian is where the article was written about that whole thing. But it's really disgusting.
Google
but anyway.
It, people.
Yeah, yeah.
That's, I mean, especially with what's happening in the world
completely.
Now.
Completely. Whoa.
These two, if this happened today, these two men would be out of the business completely. Doesn't matter how talented you are, Marlon Brando. And I don't remember who the director is. I'll look that up and interrupt you later.
Okay. But she said, you know, so she was in Taming of the Shrew, which is, like, extremely intense, right? And the male lead that she was playing against, he was in a really bad headspace, and he was, like, doing drugs and, like, all this stuff. And it was not a safe environment.
No, it's
and when
not.
You're doing something as intense as Taming of the Shrew or as intense as The Wild Party, and you're not feeling safe around one of your main leads... Like, that doesn't make for the best working. Like, it's a horrifying.
Oh, it's awful.
Yeah.
It's awful.
Yeah.
Bernardo Bertolucci.
Okay.
Or Bertolucci.
Bertolucci.
But anywho.
It's not.
Oh,
it's no just, good.
It's not. I mean, I'm all for getting different performances from your coworkers, but not at the risk of someone's comfort.
Yeah. And like mental health.
And mental health. More than comfort, really.
Yeah.
Yeah. And safety.
Yeah. Absolutely.
I mean,
like,
trust...
especially in that case,
yes.
It's like their safety.
Ugh.
Holy geez.
Can't imagine.
Well, so here's this story is a little bit lighter, but it's still.
Oh, yeah. Let's get back to the
pretty
world
good. Okay. So. This is all from the Michael Riedel New York Post article. You can look it up yourself. It's April 14th, 2000. So you can read the whole thing. But I do want to just say this little story. So Toni Collette got so fed up with his antics that she decided to get even. During one of the performances, she crept up on him from behind and gave him a retaliatory shove. After the performance, a furious Patinkin said he was quitting the Wild Party, and he did not show up for the Saturday matinee, prompting the producers to threaten him with a multi-million-dollar lawsuit.
I'm sorry, what a baby.
Yeah.
They said, turnabout is fair play.
Right. And so, but then also I heard like he would go into his,
dressing room
because he felt like they weren't giving him enough to do and like wouldn't come out because he was just like so pissed that like he didn't have enough to do.
No. When I hear stories like this about talented people that
I love Mandy Patinkin. So I'm like, please let this all be a lie, Mandy. Mm-hmm. Tell us it's a lie. Because if this is true.
I know.
I'm upset.
Makes me sad.
Very upset.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean,
at least no one's come out with like a sexual harassment suit against him.
Let's not say it out loud.
Wait.
Because I'm telling you what. Like, yes. I feel like every day there's like five people. Mm. Like, Charlie Rose, that stuff threw me for a loop.
Right?
I am upset.
You know what? Honestly, though, it's almost like I guess I'm not surprised.
It doesn't, by anybody anymore.
By anybody. Because, like, you know, like we see this public, you know, facade
of everyone.
We don't have any idea what they're really like in real life.
Right.
It doesn't make you any less disappointed.
No.
But I think I'm just no longer shocked anymore.
I'm like, especially because, I remember listening to interviews with like Goldie Hawn.
Mm-hmm.
And she would just tell stories of the quote unquote casting couch.
Yeah.
Just like these horrific situations.
Well, we've joked about the casting couch for the last 50 years.
Yeah. You know, and like everything Marilyn Monroe went through, like all these people went through. We heard all these stories. So like this is not.
It's
like
not
it's upsetting, but it's not a shock.
Mm-mm. We have really digressed. I guess not really.
No, because it's like all.
It's all connected.
Yeah, it really is. Okay.
This is the end.
So this is the end of the party. The Wild Party opened at the Virginia Theater on April 13th, 2000, after 36 previews, and closed on June 11th after 68 performances. On January 26th, just 3 weeks into rehearsals for the Broadway musical, The Wild Party, which was produced by Scott Rudin, which...
We know your feelings about Scott Rudin.
He wrote a letter. All the things. Just all the time.
He's just not been very nice lately. He's not
been that lately. Just lately.
Especially lately.
Okay.
That we're hearing about lately. Okay, fine. Go ahead.
Wrote a letter to George C. Wolfe, the producer of the Joseph Papp. George C. Wolfe was so invested in this thing. Not only did he write the book with Michael John Lacusa and direct, he also produced.
Wow.
Like, he really wanted this thing to come to Broadway and be successful. So there's an excellent New York Times article that gives so much information on the demise.
Okay.
And so I'm going to read, like, bits and bobs from it. Okay, so here's a quote from Scott Rudin. When we agreed to go forward together, I fully understood. This is Scott Rudin saying this to George.
Okay.
When we agreed to go forward together, I fully understood that you guys were going to be the lead producers on the venture, which I never had a problem with, provided that the criteria we agreed upon were put in place and adhered to, Mr. Rudin wrote. To be told yesterday... George is an artist and doesn't have time for producing issues, so contravenes the understanding that I feel it is pointless to try and continue. So he like basically like bowed out of producing. He gave like so much money.
Like I'm not the only producer, but if the other producer says that he's too busy doing the creative stuff to actually help me, then I'm out.
Right.
Basically.
Right.
Okay.
But he wasn't the only producer.
Okay. But he was one of the main.
Right. He was one. I mean, Scott Rudin gave, I believe, the most money.
Okay.
But he was persuaded to stay. And then The commercial failure of the Wild Party raised broad questions, both about the public theater and about Broadway's capacity to handle an orthodox fare. So there were a lot of questions, like I said earlier, as to, like, can audiences handle something like this dark?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I will say, like, Scottsboro Boys didn't do well either. And mm-hmm. that's, like, that doesn't have a happy ending. And it's
Here's the trouble.
Yeah.
Even if audiences came to the show and loved it, mm-hmm. if they don't come to the show, it's not going to succeed.
Right.
And so when you come, and I've said this before, mm-hmm. you come with a family of four. They're coming from Ohio. They're making
a
4-day trip.
They're not going to go see the Wild Party.
They're already paying $400 a night for their hotel.
Right.
They're already paying for their food and their airfare there. Mm-hmm. What are they going to do? Are they going to go and see the Wild Party, which
no.
they have read now is about debauched 1920s,
right.
bathtub gin, rape, murder.
Right.
Or are they going to go see The Lion King?
They're going to go see The Lion King, or they're going to go see Wicked.
Right.
Or they're going to go see Cats.
Or Phantom of the Opera. Like, any of those shows, because they know what they're getting into.
Unfortunately, SpongeBob.
Which I actually saw in the Macy's Day Parade, and it looks really cute.
We're not talking about this.
Okay.
We're not going to talk about this. Mm-mm. No, we're not. You know how strong my feelings are about this.
I'm
not
going to
talk
do.
About this.
Okay. All right. We'll agree to disagree. I mean, I've never seen it, and I've only heard a couple of the songs, but it does look really cute. And I love what they've done with some of the costumes. They're very innovative, especially Squidward. Okay, she's rolling her eyes. Go for it. Okay, go ahead. Finish. Finish your party, gosh.
Okay. Although many say the Wild Party might have been an easier time starting at the public rather than high-stakes Broadway, the public theater wanted to produce it uptown from the beginning. So, like, you know, it's another thing where we always talk about you need to have a tryout. They only had, like, two workshops, and then, boom, it was on Broadway. Where, like, I think they're right. Like, maybe, you know, maybe it would have done better. I don't know. Would it have? Because you already had one on off Broadway, you know, so then you would just have two wild parties off Broadway.
Well, and the producers of the Lipa version said it's just not going to do well on Broadway.
Yeah.
You know, so, yeah, you never know.
You don't.
Sometimes
it's a
people
weird
just
thing.
Rush to make those decisions because there's a theater open. You know what I mean? And sometimes that's all it takes.
Right.
We've got a space right now. So do we want to do it or not? Because we have to make the decision right now.
Right.
Before someone else does.
Right.
Yeah.
I'm sure, like, that's always a major piece of it is, like you said, is there a theater open?
Yeah.
Okay, the public's board chairman, Kenneth B. Lurer, said that going straight to Broadway also made economic sense because the public planned to put up just $2.4 million, or half the cost of the show, so it was only $900,000 more than it would have cost to produce it downtown at the public on Lafayette Street. So if they had just stayed at the pub, like, I guess it was like a little bit under $1 million difference,
mm-hmm.
which I mean,
yeah,
I guess I can see. I mean, you know, and then at least you have a chance at the Tonys, where if you just do the public theater, like, you don't have a chance at
that's true.
And then if it's a chance, you know, like, we still remember watching it at the Tonys.
Yes, we do.
And that's 17 years later. We still remember that.
I still have visuals in my mind
right
now as we speak. Yeah.
So, I mean, that says something, right?
Definitely.
And then also, Wolf and Lacusa said to do the show justice, they would need a big orchestra pit and a sizable proscenium stage. So, also, there's speculation as to whether or not, like, Toni Collette's agent was like, well, she'll only do it if it's going to go to Broadway. And, like, her agent says that was never said. But they're like, it was said.
Well, I mean, and I was going to say that, you know, if it had stayed off Broadway, would they have continued to have Mandy, Toni, and Eartha?
Right, right.
I don't know the answer.
I mean, obviously,
we're not in their minds, but you never know. You know, off-Broadway means a huge pay cut.
Right.
Now, obviously, that's probably different for stars.
So here's the thing that's very interesting is it said all over this article that, like, the cast still took a huge pay cut just so that it could go to Broadway.
Oh, wow.
So, like, in that respect, it wouldn't so much matter, I guess, because they wanted it to be successful so much that they were willing to not make as much money.
Well.
Yeah. So, in the end, these are the numbers, right? The public knew it could not afford to produce A Wild Party on Broadway without outside financial help. Okay? Mm-hmm. So, given that musicals usually cost from $5 to $10 million, the public spent... Oh, they had just spent $8 million on the town. So they were like kind of gun shy, right?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so Rudin's team got $4.8 million. And then the public put up... And then he said whatever went past like the amount that he gave, the public theater would need to cover. And so in the end, they ended up having to cover about $1.1 million dollars to cover the total cost to put the show up. But of course, like... There wasn't a return.
Mm-hmm.
There wasn't a profit, so. Sorry.
Yeah, sorry for you.
Yeah. So the show opened on April 13th to mixed reviews. John Lahr wrote in The New Yorker, "The enormous energy that comes across the footlights feels more like theatrical hyperventilation than revelation."
Oh, my goodness.
I know. Ben Brantley of the New York Times called it a cause for sorrowful head shaking.
Wow.
In a review that many at the public blame for the show's demise, given the influence of the newspaper's chief theater critic, of course, Ben Brantley, always. Yep. Let's see. Is this the final cost? No. Nope. 1.1 is what they gave. So altogether, that's... $5.6 million
to put on the show?
That, like, in total, because like I said, Scott said he was giving $4.5 million.
Mm-hmm.
And then the public in the end needed to cover $1.1 million.
Mm-hmm.
So okay. I think that's right. But that's like 17 years ago. So yeah. Now that's probably double that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I guess the answer is we don't know.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know what the amount is in 2017 numbers.
Yeah.
But...
No, that's okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's an interest. I mean, it's a... I was always so confused back in 1999 and 2000.
Yeah.
You know, when I first got the soundtrack and then I realized... Or the cast recording and then I realized there was another cast recording of another show that was the same show.
Yeah.
I was always so confused by that. And I always thought, why didn't they just wait?
Right. What, I felt like maybe if they... Like, that thought just passed through my head as we were talking. I thought, well, what if what they actually did was something like, wait until Vanessa had her baby.
Mm-hmm. Or... I don't know. You could have even probably changed the title and it would have made so much more of a difference.
Right.
But to have two shows named the same thing with the same source material, even if it had been the same source material, if you had a different title, it would have led people differently. I don't know. It's weird. But I think I'm still confused by the decision.
Right.
That these two men made, that these all of these producers made to just go ahead with it. Oh, hey, Andrew, Jeffrey, and I can't remember the third guy's name right now. But, just so you know, they're going to open this other Wild Party on Broadway in about a month.
Right.
So, and then they were like, yeah, that's cool. We'll be fine. And likewise, hey, Michael. Just so you know, there's already a production in progress right now in New York City. And he was like, yeah, but is it Broadway? I just don't know the conversations that they had that made these things okay for them.
Right.
They're like, yeah, but it's so different. You know what I mean? But how did you know that?
It's weird, too, because it's a thing that happens all the time in film.
Yeah.
Like you have, like, for example, Chef. So there was the movie Chef that... John Favreau did, and in that same time period, at the exact same time, Bradley Cooper was also doing a movie that was like very similar.
Yeah. Well, do you remember?
And then there's the two Jungle Books.
Uh-huh. Illusion and Prestige came out at the same season.
The same time.
And so you're like, which one is... I have no idea which one is which. I think I've watched them both, but I could have just watched one.
Well, Ed... Oh, gosh, he's such a good actor.
Ed Norton.
Yeah, he's in...
Illusion?
Yes.
Or Illusionist.
The Illusionist.
And Hugh Jackman is in Prestige. Yeah. And Christian Bale, right?
Yeah, is in The Prestige.
I think I've seen the Ed Norton one.
Okay. I saw both of them.
I think I've not seen the whole... I mean, I remember seeing scenes, maybe, but not... I don't know. But they all run together because they're basically the same movie.
It's the same.
You're right. And it's so confusing to audiences. And with movies, you watch it once and you can just forget it the next day. But with theater, you need a continuous audience coming and seeing your show.
Right.
And word of mouth is so much of that. So if you have an audience that goes and sees it and they're like, I'm really confused by this. And why are there two? And which one did you get tickets for? And oh, Myrtle, you got the wrong one. You know what I mean? Like, they show up at the Virginia Theater and they've got their tickets for the, you know, Manhattan Theater Club. Right. And you're like, oh, I'm sorry. You're at the wrong wild party. You're supposed to go over there. Yeah. You know, it's so silly to me.
Yeah.
But what are you going to do?
Yeah. I mean, it makes for a fun conversation and like totally. The two schools of thought. It's like the Jets and the Sharks.
Oh, yeah.
That's how people are about these wild parties.
I think so, too. Tell us what you think.
Yeah.
Let us know on our Facebook or on Twitter, and let us know which one is you. Are you a Lucusa or are you a Lippa? I feel like I'm asking, are you an Edward or are you a
Jackman?
What is it?
Jackman.
Oh.
Hugh Jackman.
I'm sorry. Went to Twilight.
Oh, Edward, I don't the know vampire and
what's the werewolf's name? I don't know either. Something with a J. Edward and...
I'm so old. I don't know these things.
I mean, well, I'm like, you know, the werewolf.
Listen, I'm John Hughes.
Who was the werewolf in that movie? I don't even know.
I don't know. I'm too old for this. I just like my John Hughes movies.
and?
What?
This is going to be so far away from the actual intermission episode that we just posted, which is number 5. I think it's number five that we talk about this. The one that we... Yes. So I posted intermission episode 5 and I was listening to it while I was doing it. And we talked about Martha Plimpton being in the movie Hello Again.
Right.
And I said she was in that movie with Yardley Smith. Something, something, Billy, where she like was in a standoff with police, and I don't remember anything else. So I looked this up finally, and I looked it up under Martha Plimpton in IMDb, and I could not find it anywhere. So then I looked up Yardley Smith. It's The Legend of Billie Jean, but it was not Martha Plimpton.
Who was it?
Oh, now I can't even remember.
Oh, no. Okay, wait, look.
No, let me look it up again.
IMDb to the rescue. Everybody's like, this, where, what are,
she's is this like, a, what, it's like, what? It's not Martha Plimpton. What are you talking about? Oh, what is it?
What's it called again?
Legend of Billie Jean. Helen Slater.
I have no idea who that is.
But what was kind of funny is that Christian Slater was also in it.
Oh, that's confusing.
I don't think they're related.
Are they related?
I don't think so. But anywho, so I thought I'd bring that back because I know that people are probably thinking I'm a nutso. That I didn't know the title and I didn't know what the movie was about. And I didn't even have the lead actress correct.
They don't really look alike either.
Not at all.
No.
But I think because Goonies had come out, and I think that Martha Plimpton was in Goonies.
Look, maybe. I don't know anymore.
No, I mean, like, it's just, you know what? What is it? Like the early 80s?
Yeah.
So I'm a kid.
Right.
You know what I mean? And I watch these movies. And so as a grown up, I look back and I'm like, oh, yeah, that was Martha Plimpton. And of course, I don't know. It's been 30 years since I've seen it.
Martha Plimpton is in Goonies.
Okay. Woo! And that all happened around the same time that Billie Jean came out. So anyway.
I haven't seen Billie Jean, but it looks like it's different. Is it different than Goonies? It looks like it's very, I mean, she's in like a scantily clad type outfit.
All of those 80s movies are slightly the same. But no, Billie Jean, the legend of Billie Jean was like, she was this like Texas girl who decided she's going to cut her hair, which was apparently like the thing. See, like, you're looking at me and I've got very short hair. And I cut my hair because I was like, literally like, you know what? I'm going to do it because what do I care anymore? Mm-hmm. And I kept it so long for theater, but nobody ever sees my hair in theater because we wear wigs.
Right.
But you don't get cast because you have short hair. Like, you get cast because you look whatever they want to see at any certain point. And so that was what I was fighting against when I cut off all my hair. Well, apparently Billie Jean cut off all her hair for some reason. But then there was, again, there was like a police standoff and she and her friends were like, went on the run, not for cutting your hair, but like for something else.
Okay.
But it was the start. Like, she got into trouble for whatever reason. And then she was like, you know what? Screw it. And she like took scissors to her hair in, I think, a gas station bathroom. I think that's what I recall from 30 years ago. This is the fun. Like, you know what? It's fun. But I was thinking about that earlier. And then I was like, okay, so what am I going to say when I correct that in the next episode? Mm-hmm. And I was like, you know, okay, yes, this was our scavenger hunt. And I just threw a little Swedish fish into the mix. And I went, Swedish fish? A red herring. And then I made myself laugh.
Just gonna throw some Swedish fish.
And I was like, Swedish fish, that's not the saying. Oh, it's a red herring. Well, they're red.
They're both red. That is true.
Isn't that funny?
That's hilarious.
I know.
And I was like, oh, what is funny. That even?
I know. I saw that what? In your face because I did the same thing. It's like, Swedish fish. Red herring. All right, we have got to go. It's well past our bedtime.
Yes.
I know you hear us say that
a lot. It's 9:30.
It is 9:30. I should be washed face in my pajamas in my bed reading right now. But anyway, hey guys, thanks for listening.
Thank you so much. We appreciate you.
We really do. Bye. Hey geeks, could you just do us a favor and go to Facebook at Theater Geeks Anonymous?
Also, you can follow us on Twitter at TGA.
B-way! Also, TGABUA at gmail.com.
Perfect.
To send us any comments.
Ideas for our intermission episodes.
Totally. Oh my gosh. Anything you want to send us there. Or you can also message us on either Twitter or Facebook.
Yes, you can.
Like, share, follow.
Rate, review, subscribe on iTunes.
Oh, and where else are we?
We are also on SoundCloud and Stitcher if you are an Android user.
Right. Which I'm not. I don't know. I mean, none of my friends are.
I'm just so kidding. Are we not friends? Is that what you're saying?
What are you talking about? We're more than friends. This is going way south. Okay. So anyway, thank you guys. You're awesome. Thanks for listening. Send us to all of your friends.
Yeah. If there's anybody you know that you think will like us, please tell them to listen.
Hey, if you go to college in a theater department, spread us around.
Yeah. I mean,
spread us like a sun butter.
Listen, if you want to be the ultimate theater geek and know about shows that nobody else knows about, I think you might want to be trying to listen to us.
You could be going to your 9 p.m. rehearsal going, hey, guys, have you ever heard of the show Senator Joe?
Yeah.
Or maybe something called, I don't know, Kelly? Okay.
Well, that's it. Thank you so much,
guys,
for listening.
Bye.
The Outsiders, S.E. Hinton's generation-defining novel, is now a powerful and moving Broadway hit that the New York Post is calling the best new musical of the season so far. Don't miss your chance to join Ponyboy and the Greasers and experience the classic story come to life in a whole new way. The New York Times calls it refreshing, gritty, and endlessly effective. So get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com, and of course, stay gold. They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching.
Suf's has arrived on Broadway, and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at SufsMusical.com.